Picture this. It's 1975, and you're standing in a bank in Chicago. You've saved for years, scrimped, worked overtime, kept your money in a shoebox under your bed. You've got a steady job, a good credit history, and enough for a down payment. You're ready to buy a house in your neighborhood. The loan officer looks at your application, looks at your address, and without even really considering your qualifications, he slides the papers back across the desk. "We don't make loans in that area," he says. Not because of anything you did, but because of where you live. Because your neighborhood is on the wrong side of an invisible line someone drew on a map.
Wait, they could just refuse you based on your address?
They did it every single day, David, for decades. They called it redlining, literally drawing red lines around neighborhoods on maps and declaring them too risky for investment. And those red lines? They almost always circled communities of color, immigrant neighborhoods, anywhere that banks decided wasn't worth their money.
So even if you had perfect credit?
Didn't matter. The red line was all they needed to see.
I'm David.
And I'm Sarah. And today on 100 Laws That Shaped America, we're talking about the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, the law that tried to erase those red lines and force banks to serve everyone in their communities, not just the people in the wealthy neighborhoods.
This is a big one, isn't it?
It's huge, because this law fundamentally changed what we expect from banks. It said, if you're going to take deposits from a community, you have to invest in that community. You can't just extract wealth from poor neighborhoods and only lend it back to rich ones.
So let's back up. How did we get here? How did redlining even become a thing?
It goes back decades, but it really took hold in the 1930s. The federal government itself, through agencies like the Home Owners Loan Corporation, created maps that color-coded neighborhoods based on risk. Green areas were good investments. Red areas were hazardous. And what made an area hazardous? Often, it was just the presence of Black families, or immigrants, or anyone the government deemed undesirable.
The government created this system?
The government created it, and banks ran with it for decades. By the 1970s, entire communities were starving for capital. You'd have neighborhoods where people worked hard, paid their bills, but couldn't get a mortgage, couldn't get a business loan, couldn't improve their homes because banks wouldn't lend them the money to do it.
And this was legal?
That's the thing. Banks would say they were just making sound business decisions. They'd say, "We're not discriminating against people, we're discriminating against places." But the effect was the same. Communities couldn't build wealth, couldn't stabilize, couldn't thrive.
So what changed? What made Congress finally act?
By the mid-1970s, community activists had had enough. Groups like National People's Action were organizing, protesting, demanding accountability. They'd do things like bus protesters to the suburban homes of bank executives, making the issue impossible to ignore. They'd show up at shareholder meetings. They documented the discrimination, showed how banks would take deposits from poor neighborhoods, but only make loans in wealthy ones.
Following the money.
Exactly. And they found something infuriating. Banks were taking money from working class communities and using it to finance developments in the suburbs, taking from the poor to give to the rich, essentially. And remember, this is the 1970s. There's already this growing distrust of big institutions after Watergate, after Vietnam. People were ready to believe that the system was rigged.
Because it was rigged.
It was rigged. And Congress started listening. Senator William Proxmire from Wisconsin became a champion of the cause. The evidence was overwhelming. So in 1977, as part of a larger housing bill, Congress passed the Community Reinvestment Act.
Okay, so what did this law actually do? How do you force a bank to lend money?
Well, that's the clever part. They didn't exactly force banks to make specific loans. What they did was create an affirmative obligation. The law said that banks have an ongoing duty to meet the credit needs of their entire community, including low and moderate income neighborhoods.
Affirmative obligation. That's strong language.
It is. It means it's not optional. It's not charity. It's part of your job as a bank. If you're going to operate in a community, you have to serve that community.
But how do you enforce something like that?
That's where it gets interesting. The law set up a system of regular examinations. Federal regulators would come in and evaluate how well banks were meeting community credit needs. They'd look at lending patterns, investment activities, services offered, and then they'd give the bank a rating.
Like a report card.
Exactly like a report card. And here's the kicker. These ratings were public. anyone could see them. Community groups could see them. Customers could see them. And if a bank wanted to merge with another bank, or open new branches, or expand, regulators would look at that CRA rating as part of the approval process.
So suddenly banks had a real incentive to invest in their communities.
Right. It wasn't just about doing the right thing, though some banks genuinely wanted to do better. It was about their ability to grow and compete. A bad CRA rating could block a profitable merger. It could stop an expansion. The law gave community groups real power to hold banks accountable.
And the public comment part, that seems important too.
Oh, it's crucial. The law allowed regular people to submit comments about their bank's performance. If you tried to get a loan and were turned down unfairly, you could document it. If you noticed your neighborhood wasn't being served, you could speak up. It gave communities a voice in the process.
So what happened? Did it work?
Well, it didn't fix everything overnight. But over time, the impact has been enormous. The law has leveraged billions, billions with a B, in community investment. We're talking about mortgages, small business loans, community development projects, affordable housing.
Billions?
Billions. Banks started creating special programs to reach underserved communities. They opened branches in neighborhoods they'd previously ignored. They hired loan officers who understood the communities they served. Community development corporations got funding they'd never had access to before.
Can you give me an example? What does this look like on the ground?
Imagine a neighborhood that's been struggling for years. Homes are deteriorating because people can't get loans to fix them. Small businesses can't get capital to expand. Then CRA comes along, and suddenly there's a bank willing to work with a community development group to rehabilitate housing. There's financing for a grocery store in a food desert. There's a small business loan program that actually considers character and community ties, not just a credit score.
So it's not just about individual loans, it's about rebuilding entire communities.
That's exactly it. The law recognized that communities are ecosystems. When banks invest in them, they grow stronger. Property values stabilize, businesses open, jobs are created, families build wealth.
But I'm guessing this wasn't universally popular.
Oh, you're guessing right. Banks complained that the law was burdensome, that it forced them to make risky loans, that it was government overreach. Some argued it would lead to bad lending practices, that you can't force banks to lend to unqualified borrowers.
And what about that argument?
Here's the thing. The law never required banks to make unsafe loans. It required them to serve their communities, but within safe and sound lending practices. The problem before wasn't that people in redline neighborhoods were bad credit risks. It was that they never got a chance to prove they were good risks. The law just said, look at the person, not the line on the map.
So fast forward to today. Is this law still relevant?
Absolutely. The Community Reinvestment Act is still on the books, still being enforced. Banks still get CRA ratings. Community groups still use it to hold institutions accountable. Since 1977, it's been strengthened and updated several times. Regulators have refined how they measure bank performance, expanded it to include more types of financial institutions.
Has it eliminated discrimination in lending?
No, let's be clear about that. Discrimination still exists. It's just taken on different forms. Studies still show disparities in lending rates, in loan terms, in who gets approved and who doesn't. But the CRA created a framework for accountability that didn't exist before. It gave communities tools to fight back.
What kind of tools?
Well, community organizations have used CRA to negotiate billions in lending commitments from banks. When a bank wants to merge or expand, community groups can file CRA challenges. And they've used that leverage to secure commitments for affordable housing, small business lending, financial literacy programs. It's not perfect, but it's power.
You know what strikes me about this law? It's about changing what we expect from banks.
Yes. Before CRA, banks could argue they were just private businesses making private decisions. After CRA, the law said, you're not just private businesses. You hold a special place in our economy. You use federally insured deposits. You benefit from government support. And in exchange, you have obligations to the public.
That's a pretty fundamental shift in thinking.
It is. And it reflects something important about that moment in the 1970s. People were questioning institutions, demanding accountability, insisting that corporations had social responsibilities, not just profit motives. The CRA was part of that broader movement.
How does this connect to issues we're dealing with today?
Well, think about ongoing debates about economic inequality, about who has access to capital, about how we build wealth in America. The same questions the CRA tried to address in 1977 are still with us. we're still arguing about whether financial institutions have obligations to serve the public good, or whether they should just maximize profits.
And we're still seeing the effects of those decades of redlining.
Absolutely. The wealth gap between white families and families of color in America, a huge part of that comes from home ownership disparities that trace directly back to redlining. When entire communities were locked out of home ownership for generations, they missed out on the primary way most American families build wealth. The CRA tried to address that, but it couldn't undo decades of harm overnight.
So the law is still doing work that needs to be done.
It is. And that's why fights over how to enforce it, how to measure it, how to update it for the modern banking system, those fights matter. Because at its core, the Community Reinvestment Act is about a simple question. Do banks have obligations to the communities they serve? Or can they just cherry-pick the most profitable customers and ignore everyone else?
And in 1977, Congress said,
Congress said banks have to serve everyone. They have to invest in their communities. They can't just take and take. They have to give back. It's not a perfect law. It hasn't solved all our problems, but it changed the rules of the game. It said that communities matter, that neighborhoods matter, that people who've been locked out deserve a chance.
The law that made banks say yes.
Or at least the law that made them think twice before saying no.
The Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, signed by President Jimmy Carter, still shaping how banks do business today.
Next time you drive through your community and see a bank branch, or a new development, or a small business that got its start, there's a chance the Community Reinvestment Act played a role in making that possible. It's a reminder that sometimes changing the law can change who gets a seat at the table, who gets a chance to build a life, who gets to say yes to the American dream.
One loan at a time.
One community at a time.